Just about 39 years ago, the first week of October 1981, I was fortunate to be able to go out to Berkeley and hear Heinz Kohut, the founder of self-psychology, give what would turn out to be his final talk. And he actually died later in that very same week. And that talk was called On Empathy. And Kohut began the talk by saying he had first written about empathy in 1959. And he had been talking about it for so long and so much that he was thoroughly sick of the topic by now. But the people kept misunderstanding what he meant. And so he felt that he had to give one last talk, trying to clear it all up. I'm not sure that worked. I think people went on to continue to misunderstand him, but he made that final effort. As the founder of what he called self-psychology, he introduced in psychoanalysis the concept of the self into a vocabulary that had been dominated by the Freudian ideas of id, ego, and superego. And he meant the self to be a much more experienced, near kind of term, closer to how we actually saw ourselves. But in talking about a cohesive self versus a fragmented self, or therapy is something that allowed this self to develop and increase its capacities, treating the self as a kind of structure in the mind, he set up what would be a kind of dichotomy between the self of psychoanalysis and the no-self of Buddhism. And I think I've spent just about as much time talking about the supposed contradiction between strengthening the self in psychoanalysis and trying to lose the self in Buddhism and clearing up all the misunderstandings around that, as Kohut spent trying to clear up all the mistaken understandings about empathy. And I could understand how he got thoroughly sick of it. I was reminded of it recently when I was asked to sit on a dissertation committee from someone getting a PhD in psychology trying to discuss this dichotomy of self and no self in psychoanalysis and Buddhism. And, you know, my first thought was, oh, no, not that same old false dilemma one more time. But I think that when a question like that keeps persisting, it's a sign that there's a fundamental issue there that keeps coming around and is never resolved. It's not something that can exactly be straightened out with information, but it's a sign that there's a kind of fundamental problem that keeps taking that shape. and that in one way or another, every generation has to grapple with it over and over again. So this morning, I'm going to try to review some of what is at stake in talking about no self in Buddhism, and the attendant concepts of emptiness and impermanence, the notion of a true self, or a notion of pure awareness, how all these get entangled, and reflect basic confusions in our practice and what we think it is and what we think it's aiming at. Now, it's a good idea when you want to look at what self and no self meant in early Buddhism to go back to the original context where Buddhism was in a kind of controversial dialogue with the Hindu notions of the time of the Atman and the Brahman. And there, the conventional Hindu idea was that the individual self, the Atman, was a smaller, separate aspect of Brahman, of the eternal, that within us we each had this spark of the eternal and the divine, that this was clouded over by our thoughts and emotions, desires, bodily attachments, but that the object of our practice was to get in touch with what was eternal within us. And one of the ways that was formulated was to say that our body is obviously mortal and changing. That can't be the Atman. Our thoughts, our feelings, our sensations, all those come and go and are always changing. They can't be the Atman. They're not part of this unchanging eternal essence. However, there's a thought that awareness itself was unchanging, that the contents of awareness changed all the time, but awareness itself put us in touch with this kind of cosmic consciousness. And so there was a basic split there between consciousness and the contents of consciousness. And that consciousness or pure awareness could be separated from everything that entered it. And if we immersed ourselves in that, we would be in touch with what was our impermanent essential nature. And Buddhism comes along and denies the existence of the Atman. It talks about anatman, no self, right? And that no self is a denial of this permanent essence that is supposed to be our link to the divine. And I think that if you look at it from that initial perspective, you see that self there is being used not so much in a sense that we think of it in a psychological sense, but is much closer to what in the West got called the soul. In the West, we we developed this whole language of a soul that was separate from the body and that could live on after death and have an immortal existence. It wasn't conceived of as being part of or identical with God, but the spiritual was split off from the material. The material was clearly impermanent, and there was this pursuit of something permanent. We called it the soul that could continue after death. And so that's probably the best analogy to what was going on in this kind of dialogue between early Buddhism and Hinduism. Whether there or not there's some part of us separate from our body that can continue after death. Now, Buddha is quoted in the early sutras, refused to take a stand on whether there was an immortal self or soul, or whether it was annihilated with death and simply there was an end to everything. But he did that from a particular perspective that came out of the second feature of the self or the soul, which was that it's interconnected. That it's because Buddhism said the self had no essential nature, had no permanent essence to it, what was it then? Well, what it was this set of aggregates, these sets of relations, these sets of connections to everything around it. And because the self couldn't be defined sort of anatomically out of just the its intrinsic eternal parts, the only way to talk about the self was in terms of its connection to everything else, right? And that's sort of in a sense what we do when we talk about ourselves relationally. You know, if someone asks me who I am, I'll say I'm a teacher, or I'm a psychiatrist, or I'm a father, or I'm a husband, or I'm a New Yorker. Each one of these attributes is only defined in relation to other things and other people. If I'm a teacher, you can only understand what that means by also knowing what students are and what that relationship is. If I'm somebody's father, that defines me in terms of a relationship to my son, and so forth. So everything that I'm using to describe who I really am is dependent on my describing what my relationship is to the other people and things in the world around me. And so that's the basic idea of interdependence or interconnection. If something doesn't have a single unchanging essence, what it is all these relations, and those relations are always in flux. Now, if you think of yourself in terms of relations that are always changing, you're also thinking about relations that have no boundary. Right? If I'm going to talk about who I am in terms of my relationships, they're basically infinite. I mean, I can single out the immediate family or people that I'm connected to, but I'm also part of a community. I'm part of a town. I live in a certain part of the world. All the ways I live are dependent on a whole culture and civilization and economy, and who I live and how I am ultimately is indescribable except by describing that complex context in which it happens. So the interconnected, interdependent self actually has of this very fluid boundary, so that there's no clear sense of inside or outside, right? And I think that's the best way to think about Buddha's refusal to say whether the self is annihilated with death. See, if the self has no particular boundary, if the self is this whole net of relationships with all of life, well, that net, that complex of relationships, doesn't disappear with the death of my body. If I am in some sense indistinguishable with that whole net of relationships, something about me is going to keep going even when my body is gone. So in that sense, the self as inseparable from all of life never ends, to the extent that life never ends. It's part of this ongoing whole. And even when one piece of it goes away, the whole goes on and keeps going, even though its parts keep changing. And in that sense, we think of life as analogous to the human body, in which billions of cells are constantly dying and being replaced, and yet you have an overall sense of the person continuing, even though all its individual parts and cells have grown and changed and died and are in flux throughout a lifetime. So if the individual is the equivalent of a cell, life is constantly going on in one form or another, even though its individual parts are changed or replaced. So you have these two basic ideas, impermanence and interconnection, that are going to describe the self, and that this self is really in contradistinction to any notion of a permanent immortal soul that's supposed to have an unchanging essence. But one word that got used to sum up the intersection of impermanence and interdependence was emptiness. Emptiness meant empty or of any permanent essence, anything that was immortal or autonomous, right? The opposite of interdependent is something that's completely autonomous, something that is fully contained within itself. And so the notion of emptiness simply refers to this intersection of change and interdependence. It's empty of anything permanent and unchanging. But like no self, it quickly got reified and misunderstood as if it implied some kind of void, some kind of lack. The same way no self got very quickly misunderstood to say that there was an absence of self in our ordinary psychological ways of talking. But that really makes no sense. And it makes for an enormous amount of confusion when you try to integrate the language of Buddhist psychology and Western psychology. When we talk about the attributes of a self in Western psychology, what are we talking about? Consciousness, awareness, agency, things like ego functions, which we would call things like frustration tolerance, or all sorts of developmental capacities, like when the baby learns to be toilet trained, right? That's an ego function, right? And I think one of the first things I tried to say to bring about how ludicrous it was to equate the self or ego of Zen with the self or ego that's talked about in the West is that loss of self in Buddhism doesn't mean like the loss of ego in psychoanalysis. It doesn't mean Zen masters lose toilet training, right? It's not like you're losing any kinds of these ordinary capacities that what do we mean by self or ego when we use that term psychologically. It's not being used at that kind of psychological level. In a certain sense, that one of the closer uses of it was Aristotle's use of the word soul, where he talked about the soul as the functional arrangements of parts. So his example was a candle is made of wax and a piece of string. If you just have a heap of wax and a string lying on top of it, it won't function to burn and give light in any kind of way. But if you mold the wax around the string in a certain shape, then you've created something that has the function of a candle. And so he said the soul of the candle was the arrangement of the wax and the string in such a fashion that it functioned to burn and give light. And he thought that the soul of a human being was similarly the way all the material parts were arranged that it could be alive. And if you think of the soul that way, as the blueprint or the arrangement, it doesn't have any separate existence apart from the parts themselves. You can't say that we're going to separate the soul from the body and have the soul be this extra object, right? There's the candle and the string, but there's not this third thing that's the arrangement, right? You can't, you don't in any sense sort of think that the arrangement lives after the burning of the candle. And that's the simplest kind of way to think of self or soul in Buddhism as well. That it's this kind of functional interconnection of parts that allows us to function and defines us in terms of how we're put together, not just internally, but in terms of our relations to all our contexts, the world and other people. But that arrangement isn't a thing, another thing alongside, you know, flesh and blood. And lymph, you know, bone, it's not a thing at all. Now, where this becomes relevant, I think, to practice is that many people sort of intuitively orient themselves to something like that original Hindu idea of awareness being separate from the content of awareness. That we have consciousness that's in somehow this pure empty mirror is one image, and then things are reflected in it, right? That our sensations, thoughts, or feelings are reflections that show up in the mirror, but they're not the mirror themselves, and that there's some way or another we think that we can have the mirror without the content. we think that there's some pure, empty, clear state of consciousness that we can cultivate by sweeping away all the dust or contents of our consciousness. In just as a small aside, in contemporary Western philosophy, this problem became known as the problem of intentionality. And the phenomenologists, people like Husserl and Merleau-Ponty and the Gestaltists, basically tried to create an alternative to this mirror picture of the mind and said that consciousness is always inseparable from its contents. Consciousness is always the consciousness of something, and the experiencer and the experienced are inseparable. Nietzsche had some ideas about this, where he would talk about the doer is inseparable from the deed, that who you are, it doesn't exist behind your actions, but emerges through and in your actions, right? So if I'm a teacher, that's not a kind of inner essence that I bring out. It's rather when I engage in a certain kind of activity with certain kinds of people I'm in a certain relationship with, then I'm a teacher. And the teacher is inseparable from the teaching, right? From the activity and the function of it. All these are sort of ways of trying to overcome a very basic kind of dualism that separates the inner from the outer and thought from its contents, the mind from its contents. And I think that one of the most basic kinds of things we're drawn to in meditation is this kind of idea that what we're going to do is quiet and clear the mind. And one of the reasons this kind of problem or question keeps reoccurring generation after generation is, I think, there's this basic dualistic pull in us to try to create this kind of pure inner place that will be uncontaminated by all the vulnerabilities that come with being in the world and being related and being dependent. And what we do is we're drawn to the idea of, I will sit, I'll turn inward, I'll focus on the silence in the center of my mind, what some people call the space between my thoughts. And I'll try to see if I can increase that inner silence so that the gaps between my thoughts get longer and longer, right? And there'll just be these moments of pure consciousness. And if I become a real adept, that will go on, those gaps will get bigger and bigger until maybe someday it'll be all gap, right? It'll all be clear, empty consciousness. Right? And then I will be untouchable, right? I think this is a kind of deeply ingrained curative fantasy of a certain kind of purity and imperviousness, right? It's a kind of state in which I'm not perturbed by the contents of my consciousness. Thoughts don't disturb me, emotions don't disturb me, even physical sensation, pain doesn't disturb me because I'm none of those things. I'm just consciousness itself. I'm pure awareness. You know, I'm a pool that you throw a rock in, there are no ripples, it bounces off, right? That kind of fantasy of imperviousness. And I think that there's probably, you know, a certain kind of truth in that, and that people can get themselves into all sorts of pretty exotic states of consciousness. And lots of people have used meditation in precisely that way, to try to actualize that kind of curative fantasy. And they, I think that there's a good deal of kind of yogic pursuit of clarity that tries to have that kind of pristine emptiness. And that has its roots in this original Hindu idea of pure awareness separate from the contents of awareness. But Zen is really very different from that. And for a lot of people, you know, that's the bad news, that Zen isn't going to take you in that particular direction. But even in Zen, sometimes you get this language of the true self, or the unborn, or the absolute, or something that gets reified in a way that makes people believe that it represents that same kind of impervious background state. And so that language gets very confusing for people. And one of the things I think I've talked about recently is, instead of talking about the true self, what we need to do is to talk about the truth about the self. What we're here to realize is the truth of the self being impermanent and interdependent, not that there's a true self behind the false self, right? Not when you get past this surface self are you going to get down to the real thing underneath. It's the thing underneath is simply this reality of impermanence and interconnection. Sometimes you call that life as it is. Sometimes you call it being just this moment. If whenever you see the language of the original face or the true self or the unborn, try just substituting in there being just this moment. Right? See how that changes for you, the whole feeling of that. Being just this moment is the manifestation of impermanence and interconnection. It's just this, just this, just this, right? So when we talk about no self or true self, we're not talking about inducing a special mystical kind of state of consciousness. I think that's one of the big mistakes that we fall into. When we say that the self is empty, we're saying it's just like everything else in the world. There's no self, but there's also no table and chair, right? The chair is made up of lots of parts that are impermanent and come from other parts, and it will dissolve and go away. It has no eternal essence. Every object, right? Tables, chairs, rocks, trees, the world itself, all empty. It's all impermanent and all interconnected. The self shares that characteristic with everything. You know, there's a certain kind of vocabulary that makes the self to be a uniquely non-existent thing, right? But it's non-existent exactly the same way everything else is non-existent, right? Has no permanent essence. What we wake up to when we talk about impermanence and interdependence is not some new state of affairs. It's seeing how things were all along, right? When we say that we have no self, That's where we're starting from. That's not some state that after decades we're going to achieve, although it may take us a long time to understand or appreciate or allow ourselves to feel the vulnerability and interconnection. But it's exactly where we started from. What we're trying to realize is what's been happening all along. It's like the character in the play by Molière, who is startled to discover that all his life he's been speaking in prose.